TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Struggle for History. You are about to hear the second part of one of the great archival lectures on history. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale and has taught at colleges and universities. He is the author of 19 books. In the first part of this talk, Michael Parenti had argued for the importance of history. The study of history, he said, is not only an academic discipline, it is itself a political act and is part of the political struggle. The people who control this society know this, and we ought to know it too. Now Parenti turns to the question of how to write a people's history, leading to a vivid report on some of the submerged and suppressed social history of the United States. Michael Parenti.
A people's history, I think, should also recognize that the people were the source. They were the source of most of the skills, discoveries, inventiveness, and positive contributions that made life bearable and even possible. It was the anonymous masses of people that gave us civilization, that gave us whatever productivity and comforts that we have. It wasn't the elites, it wasn't the rulers. They were too busy expropriating the surplus value to build their castles, to build their gold crowns, to wage their wars, to kill and plunder. Their inventiveness went into catapults and cannon and new forms of swords and steel and Gatling guns and gunboats and all the other instruments of destruction, nuclear missiles, and so it is on to today. Anything that has been progressive and whole and human has come from the people themselves, common people. Anything that's been life-destroying, for the most part, has come from those elites whose goal is to expropriate the wealth, the labor, the land, and the resources of people so that they could live better and better and better. I don't want to take it. To the princes and presidents and plutocrats and prime ministers and popes, to them we owe the horrors of war and conquest, the technologies of destruction and control, the rapacious expropriation that's enriched the few and impoverished the many through so many ages. A people's history should give us two things. First, an uncompromising account of the crimes of ruling interests, so much of which has been ignored or glossed over by mainstream historians. Second, a full account of the struggles of the common people of history to endure, confront, and sometimes rise against enormous oppression, a subject that mainstream history, dominant history, seldom mentions except passingly, and by the way, sometimes even disapprovingly. In the United States, the dramatic struggles of working people extending over the better part of three centuries are absent from most history texts. So are the armed accounts of the armed revolts of farmers and slaves beginning in the late 1600s and continuing through the next two centuries, the courageous struggles of the abolitionists. When I was a kid in school, the abolitionists were like troublemakers. That's where I learned about them. They kind of like pushy troublemakers who didn't respect institutions or something. The brave experiments at interracial cooperation and democracy during Reconstruction after the Civil War. That's an untold story. I never learned about it. Not in grade school, not in high school, not in university, and not in graduate school. The great industrial strikes of the 19th and 20th centuries by railroad and steel workers, tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands, by packing house employees, mill hands, coal miners, and others. Dominant history has very little to say about the pitched battles between workers and militia, the factory takeovers, and the murder of strikers by company gun thugs, police, and the U.S. Army. Samuel Eliot Morrison. They're a couple of my favorites. They're really reliable if you ever want to get perfect examples of the misrepresentation, the blather and pap of official dominant history. My two favorites are Samuel Eliot Morrison and Daniel Boorstein. And Eliot Morrison wrote a book, 1,122-page tome called The Oxford History of the American People, a book to be seriously avoided, has nothing, or very little to say about these struggles. Not a word about the champions of labor, such as John Swinton, Albert Parsons, Jacob Coxey, Henry George, W.E.B. Du Bois, Big Bill Haywood, Clarence Darrow, Mother Jones, Carlo Tresca, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Emma Goldman. Not a word. I looked in the index. Not one of them appear. In 1,122 pages, he couldn't find any room for that. Morrison's history is a celebration of establishment leadership, a compilation of Eurocentric ruling class apologetics. A study of 17 widely used high school history texts. And if you want to see what happens to history when it gets retailed and mass marketed, you have to look at the history texts. Covering the period from the Civil War to World War I, the author of the study, Jean Anion, notes that all these textbooks are marketed by a publishing industry that is big business, with annual sales of several billion dollars, owned by corporate conglomerates like CBS, IBM, Xerox, and Gulf and Weston. The textbooks, she notes, are, while claiming objectivity, all have ideological slants that tend to be pro-business and anti-labor. They all have a remarkable similarity of vocabulary, and they all are remarkably similar, I'm quoting her, remarkably similar in the judgments they come to. And by the way, this remarkable ideological homogenization, the more the homogenization, the more the claim to objectivity. Because what they do is they equate homogenization. If everybody's saying the same thing, then it's objective. If you say something different that's a little jarring, then that is then that becomes questionable. And it's what Alvin Guldner called the background assumptions, that our tendency to accept a datum or an argument as true or not depends less on the content and substance of it than it does on how congruent it is with the background assumptions we already have. But those background assumptions are, of course, established by the whole climate of opinion and the whole universe of communication that we are immersed in and constantly hear. Which is why dissidents learn the discipline of fighting and developing their arguments and arguing from evidence, while those who work within the safe mainstream work with a whole lifetime with unexamined assumptions and presumptions. The textbooks... This is a pretty intelligent crowd for that line to get an applause. I like that. That was good. All these textbooks that Jean Anion investigated, it devote a lot of space to industrial development and presume that it was a good thing for the general populace. All of them either completely ignore or gloss lightly over the staggering human costs that were inflicted upon millions of working women, children, and men. Low wages are attributed in some of the books to the willingness of unskilled immigrants to work for subsistence pay, rather than to the owner's determined power to impose low wages. 12 of the books took no notice of the American Socialist Party. 4 or 5 of the remaining dismissed the socialists and said they only had a small number of adherents. They were a small little group. This is, by the way, a party that before World War I had elected 1,200 socialists in public office in U.S. cities, to state legislatures, even one or two in Congress who weren't allowed to sit. Also 79 mayors. In 24 states, the socialist labor leader Eugene Victor Debs ran for president in 1912, and he received almost 1 million votes. It probably was over 1 million if he had gotten an honest count. This was the year when Woodrow Wilson was elected president on 6 million. So Debs getting 1 million, that was quite a bit. All these textbooks just brush off the socialists as a little inconsequential group that nobody really, just a little kind of funny little cult there. All the industrialists of the late 19th century launched themselves into business either with inherited wealth or by gaining access to large loans or by ripping off the government, profiteering during the Civil War or acquiring government funds and land from the government. But these textbooks that she studied, Jean Anion, she points out that the books offer an ideologically and historically false view of how wealth was accumulated. One of the favorite examples they gave was of Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie, a number of the texts said, started out on $1.20 a week. And he supported a whole family on that. And he managed to save. See? You don't save. he managed to save enough money, and when he got enough saved on that $1.20, he invested it and made a fortune. This could make an animated movie, maybe, but this... In fact, Carnegie's investment, his initial capital, came from a loan he got from a very rich friend. The facts aren't even right. I mean, they're just not right. Aside from what they omit and what they do say are terrible distortions. During this period of this study, of the books covered in the study, Civil War to World War I, there were over 30,000 strikes in the United States. Almost none of them mentioned in the books. A few mentioned of, you know, like the Pullman strike, the Haymarket, because there was some violence and people were killed. Those are mentioned. And generally, the impression given is that strikes are not something very good for workers to do, because it's harmful to them and it's really not in their interests. Now, these high school history texts are probably the only history that most Americans will ever read. And Anion concludes that the books served more as legitimators for the existing corporate order than as sources of critical and independent investigation. And there are similar, as you know, similar critical studies done on textbooks and how they treat the whole subject of race relations and racism and gender relations. Well, the mass marketing of textbooks reveals then what's called the mass marketing of history. Ideas and information are not disseminated democratically in our allegedly democratic society. This is as true of history as it's true of current events. History is written and popularized by those who control the communication universe. And that's the point that historians never make. When they write about what is history, the making of history, the writing of history, if you read Collingwood, read Croce, read C. Van Woodward, read Hexter, a number of them, they're talking about how the historian should do this, do that, be close to his materials, but preserve his objectivity as best he can. All these do's and don'ts. What they don't talk about is how is that history marketed? How do you then get, after you write this thing, how do you get it to audiences? You see, the assumption is that any history that any number of historians write has an equal chance to reach any kind of audiences, and that's just not true. Why is Alistair Horne's book, The Fall of Paris, that book is a book about the Paris Commune, 1871-72, when the workers of Paris, the first revolution where they actually took over Paris and held it for months against the capitalist class, against the Thiers' army, against the Prussians, with such courage and determination. A book written by Alistair Horne, that's the only book on the Paris Commune that's been in print. It's been in print for 30 years, and it hates the Paris Commune. It writes about it like they're a bunch of confused idiots. They happen to have a few cannon, and they got carried away. It says nothing about what the grievances of the workers were, what the essence of their struggle was. That's the one I find on the Paris Commune. I can't find any other book, any in print paperback on that subject. So history is marketed in a certain way. There's another teacher of history I haven't mentioned, and that's the media. The news media, you know, we always say that, you know, the memory of most news media people goes back about 3 weeks. But, you know, in some instances that isn't always true. They know how to do history in a certain way. They're corporate-owned and controlled conglomerates that faithfully reflect in content or by omission the ideological biases and presuppositions of the very corporate world of which they are an integral part. Well, you look at the media. Well, yeah, you gave example, Richard Nixon, other things like that. No, they even do things about events from 500 years ago, the anniversary of Christopher Columbus discovering America. Remember that one? They were out there talking about what an all right guy he was, and it didn't happen that he slaughtered and enslaved people. He didn't do those things. He did do those things. He wrote about them in his journal. He wrote about these people. By the way, he didn't think they were such bad people. He said these natives, these dark-skinned natives, were very gracious, very intelligent, very nice, very trusting, very innocent, Your Highness. They'll make great slaves. So, I mean, their humanity was an opportunity for him to pursue that thing that drives so many people, that makes them lose their souls and their humanity, It's called self-interest, aggrandizing yourself at the expense of other human beings and other lives. That has been one of the motor impulses and horrors of history. And our only hope is that people defend themselves against it. So you had the media saturated with this stuff, blocking out the fact that there were all sorts of people who were coming along and saying, we've had enough about Columbus, we want to give you another side to Columbus and what it all meant. That he did not discover America, he began what was called the conquest of America. There already were people here, they were not a scattered few tribes around, as Parrington and other historians have said. And Francis Kenny does a beautiful job on that. He points out how these guys actually finessed the figures. They knew. And they knew, and they didn't publish the honest figures, that there were millions, that the population of North America, of North Native American Indians, was millions more, by a factor over 100 or 1,000 more than they said. There were maybe as many as 10 or 15 or 20 million people living on this continent when Columbus came. They had societies and they had civilizations, and those first settlers wouldn't have survived if they didn't learn from the expertise of the Indians, the Native Americans, who helped them and gave them food and showed them how to plant and showed them things about things that were going on. The settlements that refused to have anything to do with the Indians died. Jamestown, every single person died because they would have nothing to do with the Indians. They were going to survive on their own. They couldn't. In fact, there was a conquest of America, a forcible, brutal, violent conquest of America. And that story, you think the media would get excited about that, right? Hey, a new story, a new angle. Hey, we only publish man bites dog, right? We don't publish dog bites man. Here's something new and different and unusual. No, very hard to get in, I can tell you that. The French Revolution. Remember the bicentennial in 1989. That was interesting. I got an interesting little file on it. I don't want to go through it. That's another whole talk. But it was a revolution that should not have occurred, I start hearing. This is amazing. A revolution of irrational excesses. That's an amazing thing, you know. The first great democratic revolution, successful revolution on the continent of Europe. The opening of a whole new age of republics. The victory of republicanism over monarchy, finally. The victory over medieval clerical clergy control and corruption, all those things. This great democratic revolution, liberté, fraternité, égalité, they're talking about it now. It would have been better off if it hadn't happened. If King Louis had been allowed to carry on his reign, and there had been gradual, slow change and all things in their time. The media fabricate history not only in the news but in entertainment. Look at the horrors, the dreadful horrors of slavery, enslaving other human beings, using them as property, dividing families off and selling them off. Birth of the Nation, Griffiths, Gone with the Wind. The way imperialism has been portrayed in the media. Militarism, whites slaughtering the savage hordes and the savage hordes in the Transvaal. It could be in the middle of the African jungles. It could be on the plains of North America. It could be off in Asia, wherever it was. But there was always these whites, the human beings, the star actors, and they were killing off these mad hordes. In other words, standing history on its head, you know, reversing the roles of victim and victimizer. Because it was the savage hordes that were coming to kill them. I mean, all their killing was done in self-defense. The nice white people in the fort or the encampment or in the wagon circle. Absolutism, autocracy over revolution. The media. Tales of Two Cities, Scarlet Pimpernel. Three sequels to the Scarlet Pimpernel. Scarlet Pimpernel Returns, Scarlet Pimpernel 2, Son of the Pimpernel. I'm not making those up. And one remake of the Scarlet Pimpernel. All these, by the way, coming out in 1989. The bicentennial of the French Revolution. There were so many Scarlet Pimpernel stories about the brave French aristocrat who's saving people from the guillotine. And the common people are portrayed as bloodlusting, crude people. Well, we'll get you, you know, and that sort of thing. They let you know who the good guys and the bad guys were. The good guys were the aristocrats, the guys with the profiles, you know, who talked in those resonant tones and so caring and loving and refined, you know. Of course you're going to root for them. The French finally made a movie called Danton, which was about Danton being a good guy. Robespierre just sits there like that. They let one line out where Robespierre says, and I felt the movie audience stir, like they a little flicker of the truth. They didn't know about that. Robespierre finally turns. You know, he's portrayed, the way history has portrayed Robespierre, as just some guy who likes to send people to the guillotine. And he says, we have to continue. We have to fight the bankers. Just the bankers and the rich will destroy us if we don't preserve this struggle for the people. And there's a line, something like that, not even quite that good. And the audience goes, hey, Robespierre, what was he about? You couldn't find out from this movie. You just found out that he was kind of a cold guy. Well, Danton was played by Gérald Depardieu, who's going, hey, hello, hey, you know, you got to love him, you know, of course. The same Danton who said the revolution should belong to the people who make the revolution. Let's enjoy it and let's get ours now. That was the hero. Anti-communism, how the entertainment media portrays that, I won't even begin that. You certainly have known that for a long time. I want to wind it up. I've talked too long. I'm sorry. This successful control of history can be measured in the results. U.S. citizens seem to know very little about real history. A survey of college students found that high percentages of them, didn't know the difference between World War I and World War II, although they had a suspicion that World War II came after World War I. Many Americans, something like 20% in the poll, 20, 30% believe that Germany and the Soviet Union were allies in World War II. I think Ronald Reagan thinks that too. By the way, that's not a function of ignorance. You know, that's information. When they say the Germans and the Russians were allies in World War II, they have an information of us, or they have disinformation. It's a function of the miseducation, the constant carping on the Hitler-Stalin pact. They never call it the Hitler-Chamberlain pact. They always call that Munich. That was a real sellout where he sold out Czechoslovakia, where the Soviets were willing and said, we'll defend Czechoslovakia and we'll fight on your side against the Nazis. They never mentioned that, by the way. They call it an alliance. Stalin never made an alliance with Hitler. He made a pact. No more than if the U.S. signed a pact with the Soviet Union would that have meant that we were allies with them. It was a pact to buy time and stall them off and hope that Hitler would go west instead of come east. But that whole harping made them, convinces many people that the Germans and the Soviets were allies in World War II. Many Americans, very high percentage, have never heard of Hiroshima. Have no idea that the United States dropped an atomic bomb on that city. Many could not tell you what issues were involved in the Vietnam War or other armed conflicts in which the U.S. has participated. You can forgive them for that one, almost, given the amount of obfuscation there. Nor can they say much about the history of aggression perpetrated against Native Americans and the slavery inflicted upon Africans in America. The centuries of imperialism imposed on Asia, Africa, and Latin America by the European and North American powers is also a huge chapter that's unknown. Imperialism. If that was a little spasm of something we did back around the Spanish-American War with Teddy Roosevelt just for a couple of years, and then we got over it. Now, Americans are not totally to blame for this. They're taught almost nothing about these things in school. And what they are taught is usually devoid of the urgent political economic realities. What little history they do learn has almost no political economic reality that would allow both the past and the present to inform each other, and that would make history meaningful and exciting to us. Well, Parenti, I mean, why bother with all these past questions? I mean, who really cares how French peasants felt about the church in 1318? Well, maybe that particular datum is not that exciting to you, but it speaks to a larger issue. We should care about the larger question, the whole process of distortion and lies about the mentality and the commitments of common people in history. And that's what makes that suddenly interesting. And that's when history becomes very exciting. When it's focused on a question that suddenly reveals something to you that's very relevant to the struggles of today and your understanding of time and human development. Malcolm X, the great Malcolm X, once said, it's a crime. It's a crime what people Not just black people, but white people too. It's a crime what they don't know about their own history. And we have not only to learn history, but I invite you to that other excitement, the excitement of unlearning history, unlearning the history that you learn. The powers that be understand the importance of inventing reality for the past as well as the present. William Faulkner, the American novelist, was right when he said, quote, "The past is never dead and buried. In fact, it is never even past. If we're lied to with impunity, we are robbed of the first condition of a democratic citizenry, how the present can help us understand the past and the past understand the present, how we can arm ourselves against the lies and calumny that are bombarding us all the time, and how history need not bore us, how history need not imprison us, but it can liberate our understanding so that we might become not its victims, but its active agents." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Michael Parenti. You heard the great archival lecture, The Struggle for History, Dissident Truth and Official Deception, recorded by KPFK in Los Angeles in May 1994. Michael Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. He comes from a poor working-class family in New York, received his PhD in political science from Yale, and has taught at colleges and universities. He is the author of 19 books, among them The Culture Struggle and Super Patriotism. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Go to the newest programs section for a link to Michael Parenti's website. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this talk. This talk is also available as film on DVD. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order really is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or the film on DVD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web at TUC Radio's website. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.